Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent shares what he has found in the aftermath of the South Asian quake.
I was able to travel through four towns that were supposed to be the worst affected areas.
We speak with a refugee council official about the worsening Syrian crisis. We'll hear about using art to overcome trauma and loss. And find out about a singer taking on the images of beauty. It's here on The Voice of America. Rescuers are working to reach remote areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan rocked by Monday's 7.5 magnitude earthquake that has killed nearly 350 people and injured 2,000 others in both countries. On the line with us from Islamabad is correspondent Ayaz Gul. Welcome, Ayaz.
Hi.
I understand from your earlier reporting that the situation might not be as dire as first thought. Please share with us what you've seen and heard.
Yeah, I was able to travel through four towns that were supposed to be the worst affected areas. As we were expecting on Tuesday morning that with the sunrise, the authorities will be able to determine the exact extent of the damage. But what I have seen in these four areas that there are, you know, damages to houses, but they're scattered, like maybe one in 10 houses got some damage. But that too was because of heavy rain that was taking place prior to the earthquake. So the good news for the region was that it was a very strong earthquake, but because of the depth of the quake, experts now are saying that the damage that is not visible and that is not there is because the earthquake was really deep, and that is why especially that mountainous terrain where the earthquake struck, people are really lucky that there was less damage as compared to what was being expected and what Pakistan had witnessed 10 years ago.
I was going to ask you, this area is frequently hit by earthquakes. Was there a chance to fully recover from previous quakes before this latest quake?
Well, there has been criticism because the damage that was caused by the previous quake was so extensive that it took Pakistan a few years with the help of international community to even complete the rescue work because it was really a massive earthquake at that time, and the damage was, it covered a vast area that where towns after towns were flattened. So that was the worry, that this earthquake had exactly the same magnitude, and people were just so scared from the previous quake that the moment this thing happened, everybody was anticipating and was predicting that it's going to be the same kind of situation when the people wake up next morning. But thank God and luckily, the damage is not so extensive. And what we have so far is the total number of deaths, that is around 230, and most of them are in those areas in northwestern parts of Pakistan, which basically borders Afghanistan, and that's where the epicenter of the earthquake was located.
What about supplies and rescue efforts for those who have been victims of this earthquake, the most recent one? Is there enough?
Yes, obviously, because Pakistan, after the previous earthquake, had put in place certain institutions and mechanisms that it was ready to deal with any calamity, and obviously the scale of this earthquake is not that big. So the rescue efforts that are taking place, obviously the authorities were able to bring emergency medical supplies and food to those areas. And these areas are actually located in high mountains, and through helicopters, they were able to drop the supplies and also evacuate injured people from that area. So there's quite a massive rescue effort taking place. But as I said, the preparedness was good enough to deal with a major disaster. But in this case, it seems that Pakistan authorities have been able to manage so far.
Well, thank you very much, Ayaz.
Well, thank you.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is VOA's Sarah Williams. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. Well, there's a lot of reaction to the quake in Afghanistan, and that's also impacted Pakistan. Reuters reports that the Taliban is urging aid agencies to push ahead in delivering emergency supplies to those affected. The quake hit as the region began to be hit by winter weather. The Taliban issued a message of condolence to those in the earthquake region. The article quotes the Kunar police chief, Abdul Habib Saeed Keel, as saying the area has insufficient food and aid. He says it's been raining for 4 days and the weather has turned very cold. Meanwhile, the New Scientist reports that geologists say the full death toll in northeast Afghanistan may be less than the 1,000 feared because the earthquake was so deep below the surface. The article says that heavily populated areas as well as cities escaped significant damage. And News 24 reports that rescuers were struggling through rugged terrain in areas controlled by the Taliban looking for earthquake survivors. Well, on a lighter note, today is National Black Cat Day in the United Kingdom. That's hashtag Black Cat Day. For those who are cat lovers like me, it's a day to draw attention to the plight of black cats. Because of ancient suspicions such as don't let a black cat cross your path, particularly as we approach Halloween this Saturday, black cats are sometimes abandoned more than other types of felines. But you shouldn't do that. They're great. Susan?
Okay, thanks, Sarah. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers have discovered a cosmic bartender hurtling through space at a speed of about 22 kilometers per second. Researchers say that as Comet Lovejoy sped past the sun last January, it pumped out large amounts of the same kind of alcohol used here on Earth to make cocktails, along with a type of sugar, into space. At its peak, the boost-producing ball of ice and rock released an amount of alcohol every second that was equivalent to at least 500 bottles of wine. The scientists say that the comet emitted a gas that contains some 21 different kinds of organic molecules that play an important role in creating some of the key ingredients for life. The discovery provides more evidence for a theory that the material needed for the creation of life is carried and delivered by comets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Norwegian Refugee Council warns that another 100,000 Syrians have been displaced in the weeks since the Russian military intervention, adding enormous pressure on regional refugee camps. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story. Victor, welcome.
Hello, Susan. Well, the Council's Secretary General Jan Egeland says the exodus is part of the intensification of military attacks. He says women, children, and the elderly are being killed or forced to flee. He said he's sick and tired of armed men and actors who have for 4 years promised military solutions in the Syrian crisis. I spoke with council official Carl Schembri, who is in Amman, Jordan. He says more than 13 million Syrian people are in need of aid, a million more than last year, while more than 6.5 million are displaced, nearly half of them children.
We have staff inside Syria who are working day and night and risking their lives just to reach in some of the hardest places. And they have informed us that they are feeling the worst, one of the largest displacements in the recent past in Syria. They are worried that they won't be able to cope with the needs, the growing needs that keep growing every day. They told us that they've even seen people carrying their elderly parents over their backs as they fled from the areas and trying to reach safer areas. The problem is that the places that they can access are actually already overstretched, and they are already hosting thousands of other displaced Syrians who were displaced earlier on.
Carl, where are these people coming from mostly?
Mostly they are fleeing from Aleppo. There have also been a surge in fighting around Hama and Idlib, those governorates. The people we know in this case of a massive displacement are heading towards the Turkish border on the outskirts of Idlib.
Are these people who normally you thought might leave because of the ongoing fighting that seems to go on and on, or is this because of the Russian intervention?
Well, the fighting keeps going on from all sides, and we've seen a surge from every armed group over the last few weeks. The truth is that Syria is becoming completely unlivable, and thousands keep fleeing from every part of the country. The current surge that we have seen is extremely worrying because we are already at beyond full capacity in catering for the needs inside Syria. Just let me remind your public that over the last years, now 5 years into the Syria crisis, the needs inside Syria for displaced people have increased 13-fold. 13 million is the latest need, the $30 million, which are completely unmet by the donor funding that we are receiving.
A UN representative indicated that Russia's intervention in Syria is facilitating President Bashar al-Assad's war on civilians. Is he actually targeting civilians, in your view?
Well, as a humanitarian agency, we do not track the actual attacks. What I can say is that civilians are the ones who are bearing the brunt of this war. This is civilians and civilian infrastructure that we keep seeing all the time coming under fire from all sides, from every side. We've seen hospitals, schools, houses, women and children coming under fire. They are the ones who are carrying the brunt of this war. And that's why we can step in to a certain extent as far as funds allow us to help as humanitarian agencies. But it is ultimately a political solution, the only solution to this conflict. No more military interventions, wars, and fighting can bring us anywhere near to an end to this conflict with full respect to the civilians' human rights.
Carl Shembri says a political solution is the only way out. On Monday, the United States said it hoped a multilateral meeting could be arranged before week's end on a political transition in Syria. State Department spokesman John Kirby repeated the U.S. view that President Bashar al-Assad has lost all legitimacy to lead Syria. The Russian Foreign Ministry on Sunday said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov discussed the prospects for an internationally backed political settlement that would involve Syrian authorities and what's called the patriotic opposition.
Thank you for that report, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, through art comes hope. Anna Singer takes on the fashion world. Out of struggle and despair often comes hope. That is the idea behind a new art exhibit in Baltimore, Maryland, called The Big Hope Show. Correspondent Deborah Block joins us on the line to talk about the event. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Sue.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit more about what is behind this project?
Well, the idea came from the founder and director of the museum, Rebecca Hofberger, who wanted to show that despite all the struggles people experience in their lives, that the power of hope not only helps people survive, but to blossom and perhaps even improve their lives. As far as the artists themselves, the idea was for some of them to show how their art has made their lives even richer during the struggles and traumas they've experienced.
How big is it? I mean, how many artists?
The exhibit consists of about 25 artists who express themselves in a wide variety of ways, including painting, beadwork, using colored pencils or glass. The privately owned museum, by the way, only exhibits work by self-taught artists. So all these artists in this Big Hope Show have also learned their craft on their own.
Is the art any good?
Oh, the art is fantastic. It's the museum itself, by the way, is kind of quirky. It's unusual, whimsical, thought-provoking. So the pieces in this show reflect those ideas. One piece that's especially moving is done by an artist named Dan Petrell. He created a glass mosaic, several pieces that are just beautiful with leaves set in window panes. And he did this in honor of his wife, who died a couple of years ago in her 40s. She suddenly died from cancer. And he wanted to honor her memory. So he created this mosaic, and he even put some of her ashes in it, which to some of us might seem a little morbid, but to him, he says that it gave him comfort. Another artist who is particularly interesting is an American woman who became a voodoo priestess in Haiti, and she had one of the more prominent pieces in the show. It was a big beaded sculpture of birds in a cage topped by a white female figure that represented a voodoo spirit. And that spirit is searching over the birds, which the artist says represent seeds of hope. And then another really beautiful piece was this lovely colored pencil drawing of a girl who is about to become a teenager. And her body is covered with cocoons that burst around her head into butterflies. The idea, says the artist, is that even this girl, who will have her ups and downs and her struggles as a teenager, she'll also have her beautiful moments, too.
Well, thank you very much, Deborah. It sounds very interesting.
It was very interesting. Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
One man's trash is another man's treasure, and in Indonesia, you can bank on that, literally. A government initiative has established a few trash banks where residents like Yuliang Engshi can gather up recyclable bottles and deposit them at a bank in Cimahi. This is so I can have a little extra saved up for my expenses. The trash bank in Cimahi was initially set up 5 years ago by the Sanitary and Environmental Agency. Budi Raharja is head of the sanitation agency. He says they would eventually like to expand into recycling.
As of now, we're still focusing on the collection process, collecting trash from our residents, which we then sell to garbage collectors or have it collected for processing.
A recent study indicates Indonesia is the world's second largest plastic polluter, generating more than 3 million tons of mismanaged plastic waste in 2010. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Musician and actress Zendaya recently criticized a French fashion magazine for altering her image after a photo shoot. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the issue, which has the 19-year-old singer taking on the images of beauty, both thin and not so thin.
Shauna, Zendaya is a beautiful young woman, and yet when she was in this model shoot for Modeliste magazine, they photoshopped her to make her a little bit more zoftig, a little rounder, you know? It was like she's a thin young woman.
She is. And keep in mind, she is also a young woman. She's also very tall. So, and this is something that she's talked about in the past, the fact that she felt a little insecure about being as tall as she is and as thin as she is. So I think that's what prompted her reaction after seeing the touched images that were to appear or that did appear in this magazine.
And the shot in question, she's in briefs and a black leather jacket, and she's kind of in the traditional S shape that they put fashion models in. But they made her hips and her thighs a little rounder, a little thicker. And was that to appeal to a certain audience, or did they just think she was too skinny, or what?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. There are differing standards of beauty, and they change as time goes on, as time changes. And now we know that a slightly more curvaceous body is more appealing, and it has always been to men. And I think that that, again, is a problem, that we're talking about a young girl that they were attempting to alter in a way that could potentially make it more appealing to older men, but also to set this standard, I think, for young women. Setting unrealistic standards for young women in fashion magazines, music videos, everywhere, really.
Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go. Put you on repeat, play you everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, play you everywhere I go.
There was an article a couple of days ago about a woman who is slightly curvaceous, who gave her husband a photo book of boudoir photography.
I saw that, yeah.
And he said, I don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like my wife. You know, and so the photoshopping of this image, which she intended to be kind of an idealized version of herself, he didn't like.
Yeah, it took away. And I thought it was beautiful what he said, because he's like, you know, you erased our life together.
Yeah.
You know, you erased the children that we have. You erased the laugh lines. You've erased everything. And it's even worse now, because before that was just something that you saw in magazines. That was the standard for people who were in the public eye. Now, with all of these apps and everything, anyone, I mean, I do it sometimes. If I take a picture and I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't like that. Filter it. Or, you know, you can now Photoshop your own body and extend it and do all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, really, I like what she's doing, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, when you walk down the street, we all see what you look like in
the
real world anyway. You look like you. Okay.
All righty. Yeah. Well, if you have any comments on this, please send them to us. You can tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can tweet to us at VOA underscore IE. You can also comment on our webpage. That's voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is a scourge from which no country is immune. It is estimated that globally, one out of three women faces violence during her lifetime for no other reason than her gender. As unfortunately commonplace as gender-based violence is under normal circumstances, it increases exponentially during conflict, natural disasters, and other humanitarian emergencies. In emergency situations, societal structures break down, and women and girls in particular face an increased risk of gender-based violence, including sexual exploitation and abuse, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, and trafficking. That is why 2 years ago, representatives of a number of governments, transnational organizations, NGOs, and civil society organizations met in London under the leadership of the United Kingdom to form a call to action on protecting girls and women in emergencies. The United States took on leadership of the call to action in 2014. As a commitment to the call to action, the United States announced its Safe from the Start program, an initiative that aims to address and reduce the incidence of gender-based violence in emergencies. We have used Safe from the Start funding to help our partners assist thousands of displaced Iraqis. Safe from the Start supported training for refugees from the Central African Republic on how to respond to sexual exploitation and abuse, setting up complaint mechanisms and emergency phone lines to report abuses. And in the Congo, we are helping to establish security patrol teams and install solar lights in communities so that women and girls are able to venture outside after sundown. At a ministerial on gender-based violence in humanitarian emergencies, a meeting co-sponsored by the United States and Sweden, Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $17 million for Safe from the Start. If we are to be successful in this effort, said Secretary Kerry, we need to take action. We need a zero-tolerance policy toward gender-based violence against anyone, men, women, and children. We must treat the survivors of violence with the sensitivity, respect, and the dignity that they deserve, and we must bring perpetrators to justice. Finally, to be successful, we must all work together. We have learned in painful and searing ways that gender-based violence can rip families apart, rip communities apart, and attack state structures. And too often, in too many countries, it perpetrates conflict and creates instability for generations, said Secretary of State Kerry. Preventing and dealing with the effects of gender-based violence is a fundamental moral issue. It's a basic question of right versus wrong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.